We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a special episode of my 10 Questions podcast, where my guest is legendary US comedy writer Nell Scovell. Nell started her career writing for Spy Magazine and Vanity Fair. Since then, she's written for The Simpsons, Letterman, Murphy Brown, Newhart, NCIS. She created Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and she was executive producer on Charmed. She's written jokes for Obama. She co-wrote Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg's best-selling book, Lean In. And her autobiography, Just the Funny Parts, is an enthralling book. If you're ever stuck or feeling alone as a writer, dip into Just the Funny Parts, and I'm certain it'll bring you out of your funk and inspire you to stay the course. It certainly did that for me. I interviewed Nell in Sydney in front of a live audience at the invitation of Jungle Entertainment, where she's currently working with a bunch of Australian writers. As usual, I started by asking Nell when she was most happy, and she recalled the period of being pregnant and bringing up her children.
Original plan was I would carry the baby for the first 9 months and then he would carry it for the next 9 months. And then what we learned was he was a spectacular caregiver, like way more patient than I was. And so we just kept going. But it was hard being a working mom. I was often... You know, I missed a lot of dinners. In fact, in the book, I talked about how I made breakfast the family meal because I knew I would always be there at 7:30 and 8, and we would have crepes Thursday, every Thursday, and I would make the boys crepes. But I used to say a good day was a day I got to see my kids because it didn't always happen. Sometimes if I was directing, I'd be out of town or you know, producing up in Canada. And so now the kids are grown, they're at college, and I have a father who's 91, who lives in Boston, and once the kids went off to school, I realized I could move closer to my father, who's just a wonderful, funny man, and now I say a good day is a day I get to see my dad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think you got your, sense of humor from your father?
I did. He's really, I took him, he had cataract surgery just last week, and I took him to the hospital, and he introduced me to everyone as his parole officer.
That's good.
Yeah. So.
Did he improv that, or did he think about it earlier?
I don't, he's just very funny, man.
Yeah. Did, I do want to touch on the fact that you moved from Spy and Vanity Fair to writing, just to screenwriting, and was it your first spec script, was that it's the Gary Shandling Show?
Yeah. So, I mean, the transition, the only reason it occurred to me was I bumped into an old editor from Spy one day on the streets of New York, and she said to me, Nell, I don't mean this as an insult, but I think you could write for television. And it was the first time it ever occurred to me.
Yeah, right.
Well, now we're in this sort of golden age when people know the names of TV writers. But, you know, when I grew up, and especially on the East Coast, it was like, oh, right, people must write those shows. Like, it just didn't seem like a profession. It still doesn't quite seem like a profession.
I went to a shrink once who actually thought the actors wrote the...
right. Yeah. The characters write their own lines.
That's right.
Yeah.
Have you met any actors?
So I won't name names, but I once, and this wasn't me, but I was working for an executive producer who, one of the actors had a problem with the line, and so he said to her, well, what should she say instead? And then let her just stammer for 2 minutes and then went, we'll think of something.
I do like those stories. Question two is, now, who would you like to apologize to and why?
Well, this audience. No, so I think women apologize too much. I was not too long ago in a bookstore, and I was sort of, it was pretty crowded, and I was kneeling looking at a book, and I heard a woman say, "Excuse me," and I was petrified, so I popped up, which kind of sent her back a step, and she knocked another woman, and I said, "I'm sorry," and she said, "I'm sorry," and the other woman said, "I'm sorry," and we three sorries, like, within a second. And that's, we're just naturally always apologizing.
And how do you change, like, get out of that? Because it's almost addictive, saying sorry.
Right. I mean, they actually started that sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
Movement. Is it a movement? I don't know. It's certainly a thing people say now.
Are you apologetic for, is there anything, like, from a professional point of view?
Oh, yeah, you know, people, there's a thing in Hollywood where no one's ever worked for a bad show, right? It's like, well, you should read the scripts.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the studio notes are killing us, or the budget is killing us. So I'll apologize for a few charmed scripts I wrote. They were not good.
Heavily noted.
Yeah, that's right. The network noted them.
Question three, I guess this is the kind of segues in. What is your greatest regret?
Oh, I was thinking of reading a story from, that's not in my book, but it's about Colin Firth.
Yeah.
May I do that?
Oh, wow, yeah, totally. While that happens, I just want you to know, I'm going to throw to the audience at the end of this so you can ask some questions. So if you are thinking of anything you'd like to ask Nell, we'll do it at the end. Okay, Colin Firth.
So this isn't in the book. This is all fresh. So it's a setup, but walking into a Vanity Fair Oscar party is the oddest feeling. You recognize everyone and know no one. It's wall-to-wall movie stars and celebrities looking gorgeous and cool, except the year that Sergey Brin walked around wearing Google Glass. I've been attending the party on and off since editor-in-chief Graydon Carter took over in the early 90s. Back in those days, there was a clear distinction between the big and little screen. So that for me, I was a TV writer. This was a whole new experience to be part of this movie star-studded crowd. My first year attending, I made a loop around the room, then paused in the center of Morton's to survey the room panoramically. I wanted to remember the moment forever. "I need you to move," barked a man in a do-rag carrying a camera. It took me a second to realize he was speaking to me. And then I froze, not sure which direction I should move. "Now," photographer Bruce Weber yelled at me, "you're ruining my picture." He gestured behind my shoulder, and I turned to see that behind me stood Muhammad Ali, pretty as ever, posing with Madonna at the height of her career. And yet that was not the most cringeworthy star interaction that I've had at the Vanity Fair party. It was 2011, the year the King's Speech won a slew of awards, and the party was at the elegant Sunset Towers. Around 1 a.m., I headed outside and handed my ticket to the valet captain. I was standing under a heat lamp when a stretch limo pulled up and the valet waved to a group that included the winner of the Best Actor Award that evening, Colin Firth. They all moved toward the limo. Ever the gentleman, Colin held the door open for his all-female entourage that included his wife, his publicist, and two others. With the high heels and long gowns, it took a while for the women to slide in. And as Colin stood facing the sidewalk, his gaze eventually fell on me. There was maybe 8 feet between us, and I could see the triumph of the night flashing in his eyes. He flashed me a roguish smile. I smiled back. Colin Firth and I were having a moment. And I didn't want the moment to end. I had loved his performance, and this was a chance to let him know how happy I was for him and how much I thought he deserved to win. I was already smiling, so I needed to do something more, and that's when I called out, "Well done, Mr. Darcy." Immediately, his face dropped, and he lowered his gaze. He shook his head. I swear to God, he did. He spun around and pretty much shoved the last lady into the limo, slid in next to her, and quickly shut the door. Clearly, I had insulted him, but how? I thought, well, now I know how Elizabeth Bennet felt. But I truly did feel guilty. This was a high point of his career, and somehow my four words had darkened it. The next morning, I told the troubling sister to my dear, told the troubling story to my dearest sister Claire, and she immediately chastised me. "Don't you know? He hates to be reminded of that part," Claire explained. "He says it in every interview that he's gotten over playing Darcy, and women need to get over it too." So that was my sin. Colin Firth finally buried his chick-lit past, and like in a horror movie, I'd reached out from the grave and grabbed his well-formed ankle. So I moaned to my sister, "How could I have done that to him?" And she cut me off. "You know," she said, "if he doesn't want to be associated with Mr. Darcy, then maybe he should stop playing him." An excellent point. Yeah. Colin Firth had accepted that role not once, not twice, but three times, and a fourth since then. He played it old school and then updated it for Bridget Jones. And did Mr. Darcy deserve such hate? Without Mr. Darcy, would he ever have had the chance to play King George? And it made me realize that in our moments of greatest triumph, it would be wiser to reflect and even relish where we came from. After all those years of playing Mr. Darcy, had Mr. Firth learned nothing of either pride or prejudice?
Joke's on you, Colin Firth.
Isn't it? The joke is, because my editor was like, nobody cares about Colin Firth. That's why she cut the story.
We can't. So that's a stern word with your editor. Question four is, what will you still need to do to feel you've lived a satisfactory life?
Well, now that I've seen Australia, you know, it's that I enjoy writing, I enjoy my family, I enjoy my friends. I guess just having a not painful death is all I'm looking forward to. I got no complaints.
No one's ever said that.
Question five is, who is the person who most influenced you and how?
Oh, how many people here are aware of Albert Brooks and his movies?
Oh, yeah.
A lot?
Mm-hmm.
So I tell the story in my book about being in New York and bumping into friends who worked at Saturday Night Live who told me I should go see this movie called Real Life. It had come out before, but it was playing at some revival theater in New York. And that movie changed my life. Because I had grown up, and I loved the Marx Brothers, and I loved Woody Allen before he started dating his relatives. And but if you think of that kind of comedy, it's very shticky. It's very, even Steve Martin, they're winking at the camera. It's big. And I go see Real Life, and if you haven't seen it, it's even funnier now because he's spoofing reality TV. He was spoofing the Loud family. And there's a moment where Albert's playing a director named Albert, and they're following with these really goofy-looking cameras a family, and the wife, they've just come out of the gynecologist's office, and she's gotten bad news, and she says to him, "I'd like to be alone." And he says, "I understand. Could we go with you?" And it was just this little moment when I was like, oh, he didn't hear himself. You know, he wasn't winking at the camera.
Yeah.
And I actually thought, I think I could write that kind of comedy.
Mm. Yeah.
So, and all his movies, I think Defending Your Life is one of the most perfect essays about morality or how we should each live our best lives. I mean, it's a stunning film.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned him. I, He didn't write broadcast news, did he?
No, he starred in it.
He starred in it. Yeah. So, but that was one of the... I listened to this podcast recently where Aaron Sorkin says that was the thing that inspired him to actually be a writer, because you didn't know that people could actually write like that.
Yeah.
You know, but you weren't allowed to actually say those idiosyncratic things, you know, because everything was winking or a bit kind of staged. So that reminds me in a way of real life.
Well, he has that sign, I write it here, it comes out there. When he's talking about William Hurt. But I'm sure Albert, he was good friends with James L. Brooks, wrote the screenplay.
Right.
But I have to believe Albert had a hand in that.
Well, yeah.
He also did Lost in America. Oh, here's another reason I love Albert Brooks, is he co-wrote most of his movies with a woman, with Monica Johnson, who's very funny. Sadly, she died a few years ago, but... He really wanted his female characters to be dimensional. And if you watch Lost in America, she's the one who gambles away the nest egg. And it's very, I think a lot of men will put women on the pedestal and not let them have those flaws.
Yeah. And you can follow him on Twitter too.
He's fantastic. Twitter. Yeah.
Question six, when was the last time you cried? Why?
So, when the Mueller report came out and Bill Barr sent that 4-page letter, and I had that moment of, they're going to get away with it, and that just destroyed me.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any recourse?
No.
You find Nell on Twitter, you also get a bit of politics as well.
I used to be funny, and now I find it very hard. Do you? I mean, to be...
I've never been funny, but no.
Okay.
Why start now? On a professional sense, have you ever been like in a situation? Is it? You've spoken a lot about being a pioneer. You were a pioneering female writer in comedy rooms. Was it bad to be seen to cry ever?
Oh yeah, yeah. Or show any weakness.
Mm.
I remember once having the flu, being in the room, going into the ladies' room, throwing up. You know, brushing my teeth and going right back to the room, because that's like you could never ever show any weakness.
Yeah. And you can never be sick in Hollywood, can you?
It is. It's like it's the herd mentality, and if you're the weak gazelle, they're just going to run away from you as fast.
Everything you read about it is true.
Yeah.
Question seven is, what is your current state of mind?
Oh. Actually, I'm so happy. This is the first time I've been just consulting on this amazing, they're making a show out of this brilliant novel, Burnt Snow. I've never been in a room where the women outnumbered the men.
Oh, wow.
And I'm enjoying that immensely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that. What's the difference?
No difference at all.
Okay.
Fewer bags of potato chips consumed. I don't know. That's... but...
Right. And what about the Australian sensibility? Have you noticed anything different?
Oh, actually, there is one difference. I'm the only one interrupting other people in the room, which I'm trying so hard not to do, but I'm so used to it.
Yeah, yeah.
People are polite here.
We are, until we get a few drinks into us. Question eight, what do you consider your greatest achievement?
Well, I'll say professional would be working with Cheryl on Lean In, which, you know, I do think changed a lot of lives and sold, I don't know, 4.5 million copies worldwide. And, like, in China, it's actually had a huge impact. We now have 100 women in Congress. You know, 5 years after Lean In came out, I think there's probably some connection.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I still get emails from...
Do you mind telling them a little bit about it?
Okay, are aware of...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Yeah. So Lean In was a concept Cheryl came up with. And just so you know, so I had a friend who worked in communications at Facebook, who one day I had started being more outspoken about feminism and TV, and gender discrimination, more specifically, or equality. And he asked me if I had seen Sheryl Sandberg's TED Talk, which she gave in 2010. It's so good. It's called Why We Have So Few Women Leaders. I really strongly suggest anyone watch it. So he said, have you seen it? And I wrote back, seen it. I memorized it. And he said, I think you two would get along. And, you know, as they say, it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And she asked me to help her with speeches. She was very busy. She had two very young children. And she kind of knew that, like, being funny was important to getting that message across. And she is actually very funny and very charming. In fact, I wanted to read you this. Just I meant to do this at the beginning to establish expectations. But this is, the book comes out. It's this huge splash. New York Magazine decides to do a little profile about me and includes these sentences. At first glance, Scovell could hardly be more different from the Facebook COO. She does not radiate Sandberg's upbeat poise or fill the room with effortless charisma. So you're witness, this is forced charisma. Anyway, the point of, so the first time she came up with this phrase, lean in, and she used it in a speech she gave at Annapolis, which is the Naval Academy. And it's really, it just means be ambitious. It's all about giving women permission to be ambitious, which our culture does not do. And the genius of Lean In is it's just, it's so small. It's just, well, I'm not taking over your job. I'm just leaning in. Yeah. And we always joke that if I had written the book alone, I would have called it Barge In. So she's a much better marketer than I am. But she truly feels, and the line is that the world would be a better place if half our companies and institutions were run by women and half our homes were run by men.
Mm. And how did you find her voice? How did you actually write for her?
Well, that's where my TV background just came in so handy. You know, it really, I hadn't done speech writing, but it really is a combination of journalism and dialogue writing. Mm-hmm. And I always joke to her that next to Murphy Brown, she's my favorite character to write. Wow. But it is. It's this. It's a very similar process. And I often, you know, TV writers are having a hard time getting jobs, I often say, have you thought about speech writing?
Yeah.
Because it's a really fun way to do what we do. And in fact, I think it has more impact.
Mm. Yeah.
So I love writing speeches. I do a lot of it now.
Really?
Yeah.
Politically? Political stuff?
Some, right. Yeah.
And just on while we're on Greatest Achievement, what's your favorite individual screenplay you've written?
Oh, that's a... Or TV show, or
that's what I mean.
Like, episode
could be. Let's start with episode, or do you want to start with TV show?
Well, I mean, The Simpsons. I just saw that it's in the top 10 on IMDb of the greatest Simpsons of all time. Wow. And wait, no, let me tell you. It's Homer eats blowfish and thinks he's going to die. That was an idea.
What season is that?
Two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tasty poison fish, tasty fish.
Might just talk. So, predominantly writer. So what was that process?
Well, there's a whole chapter about it in my book. And what people don't understand is I saw the very first Simpsons and I loved it. And I called my agent and said I want to write on the show. And now it's a cultural phenomena, but truly back then, the reason I got to write one is nobody else was calling and saying, I want to write for that show. But much like real life, I just kind of went, oh, they're being mean to each other in funny ways. That was sort of like Spy was kind of like that too.
Yeah, totally.
And you know, when you think about it, it was 1990. You know, there was still a lot of hugging in sitcoms back then. So I remember a scene in The Simpsons where the family goes to therapy together, and they're hitting each other with the bats, and he goes, wouldn't these work better if we took the foam off? And I just thought, oh, that's so funny.
That's great.
Anyway, so I went in and I pitched a bunch of ideas, including Homer eats blowfish and thinks he's going to die. And another weird thing is in 1990, sushi was just coming into America. Mm. Like, I remember the first time I had sushi in the 80s. And so you could still, like, it was still kind of a subculture to make fun of.
So Simpsons, probably one of your, is that your favorite?
And, you know, I love Sabrina, great boss. And, you know, that was obviously very much my sensibility. So.
And do you, and your recollections, just like, I just want to pass through, so Letterman, what was the, I know there was difficulties there, but what are your memories?
Oh, so, well, what was great about Letterman was it was back in the days they did a top 10 list, and you would, in the morning, you would pitch different ideas on what it could be, and some of them were, based on topical news, or, you know, you'd come in and go, oh, what if it's Siegfried's top 10 pet peeves about Roy? You know, you know, too much. So then you would get whatever the topic was at 3, and you had an hour to just write all the jokes you could think of. And so it was like comedy writing 101. Yeah. I remember like one where it was like top 10 signs you have a bad doctor. And it was like when he's handing out prescriptions, he says one for you and one for me. When he says it's 2 livers and 1 kidney.
So I know it was that very blue one that Dave Letterman talked about in the top 10 jokes he could never say, and it's like, how do you know you got a bad doctor? When he takes your temperature with his dick.
Oh, man, that's... No, I actually... And I, in that same group, I pitched when he asked to hold the specimen cup.
Can I ask, so is it... so 10 is the best joke?
No, often... Well, often one is not the best joke.
No, I know.
Yeah. 10 often, yeah.
Actually, 10 was the best.
Did you?
No, it's right.
My very first entry into the top 10 list was number 10. Ooh. So I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, no, I just literally, that was just a layman's kind of look at it. Question 9, who would you want on your side in a battle and why?
Well... Thanos. No, I have a brother-in-law who actually spent a lot of time diving on the Great Barrier Reef and like riding motorcycles around here. And he's very clever. Yeah. He's a marine biologist. He knows a lot. But I have he was going to be my answer until I met Van Batten. And now that's who I want my side in a battle.
She didn't take long to...
No. Yeah. Oh, instantly. Yeah. Her.
Where is she, man?
Where is she? Yeah.
Professionally, in like from who would you... In the States, who's in your dream writer's room?
Oh.
Who would you...
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you do... Like, you don't want all just funny people. Like, you really... There's story, there's character, there's jokes... Like that emotion person, like
so
someone.
A multifaceted room is really.
Yeah, cool. Like I always say, you cast your writer's room like you would cast an ensemble in some ways. Like you want those different voices.
Yeah. Oh, that's really great. That's really good to know. Just on a personal level, I mean, you talk about in the book meeting Gary Shandling.
Yeah.
So you pitched. You took your. Did he read your spec script?
He did. Yeah. He did. They bought it.
Yeah.
They flew me out to Hollywood, I flew all the way from New York to Hollywood to get notes from Shandling, who then, as soon as I walked in the room, said, I don't feel like giving notes today. Is that okay? I don't know what to say. And I ended up not getting notes while I was there. But he and I play ping pong. And he's quite a good ping pong player.
Sounds basketball or ping pong.
Yeah, he did it. There was a famous Gary Shandling Show episode based on The Natural. Do you know that story about the baseball? But it's he plays ping pong.
And the final question is, what would you like your last words to be?
Oh. I don't know the exact wording, but I know that I want my last words to be me yelling at my clone to get revenge on whoever murdered me.
We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.